I'm Alonzo Duralde, and you're listening to the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben. How's it going?
It's going well. Hey, who's that other person on the podcast?
Hey, joining us today is Alana Cody, producer of the show. Alana, yay, say hello to all the nice people.
Hi, nice to see everybody.
Hey,
can you see them? No, oh my God.
You know what I mean.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
You don't see me on camera very often.
I just see you two.
Or hear me either.
All right, so Alana, who is on the show today?
Today we have Alonzo Duralde, who is a film critic, and he wrote a book recently called Hollywood Pride.
And what's the book about? Can you tell me, can you say anything about the book before we go?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Sure. It's a pretty exhaustive study all the way from the beginning of cinema of actors, directors, and films dealing with, you know, gay and queer issues.
Excellent. Excellent. I can't wait to hear the interview.
And now, Close Focus.
So, for our close focus today, Alana, it was an idea that you had to talk about something that went on recently in Hollywood. What are we talking about for Close Focus?
Well, let's see. The Creative Arts Emmys just happened this past weekend on Saturday and Sunday, and that included cinematography.
All right.
So, oh, well, the most important question is, how many of our interview subjects won Creative Arts Emmys?
Well, none.
No.
All right. So that's too bad. But who were the big winners? Who did actually win at the Creative Arts Emmys?
Let's see. Well, Shogun was the big winner. It dominated with 14 wins.
Wow.
Yes. And the other cinematographer who we didn't have the pleasure of speaking with, Sam McCurdy, took home the cinematography Emmy for Shogun. We spoke with
Christopher Ross.
Christopher Ross, yes, thank you.
All right. Well, any other notable highlights from the Creative Arts Emmys this weekend?
So, for a multi-camera series, we have How I Met Your Father. This cinematographer Gary Baum, ASC. So sort of like a sitcom. Cinematography for a single camera series, Half Hour. Andrew Weed, director DP for The Bear.
Freaking amazing show.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then Sam McCurdy won for Shogun. And then Ripley with Robert Elswit.
We had on the show, just not for Ripley.
We have, yes. And then
man's a freaking legend.
I have so outstanding cinematography for a nonfiction program was Girls State, and the cinematographer for that was Thorsten Thilo, if you've spoken
Thorsten.
With him before.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we have outstanding cinematography for a series was Shogun, which we mentioned. And then there was outstanding for a reality, Life Below Zero. And the DP was Charlie Beck. And then let's see for.
And didn't Idea Man, what did Idea Man win?
So Jim Henson Idea Man, it won outstanding documentary or nonfiction special. So it won the big prize.
So Vanya,
it also won editing.
Oh, that's great. So yeah. Vanya, who we talked to, he didn't win best cinematography for that, but the show won. So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's still the a winner because he won. Yeah.
Yeah. It's sound editing too. Editing and sound editing.
Such a good documentary.
So I guess that's the basically the overview of some of the points of interest for us about the Creative Arts Emmys.
Well, congrats to everybody who won. Some just amazing work. And I think we can't state enough that, like, not only was it amazing work, but almost everything that won an Emmy was made during COVID. So, like, they, you know, Shogun and stuff, like, they were making that stuff the hardest way you could possibly make a show like that during COVID. Not like today, where we just breathe in everybody's germs all the time again.
Yes.
All right.
I can't follow that.
I mean, what are you supposed to say to that? I mean, I still mask on airplanes.
I immediately had a thought that was totally just not appropriate for the show. So then I just figured I'd keep my mouth
Whenever
shut.
I have one of those thoughts, I just blurt it. I just blurt it right out. Just comes right out of my brain pan.
All right. Well, okay. Then if we're going to get to the interview with Alonzo Duraldi, I should do a quick disclaimer. There is no video if you're watching us on YouTube for this interview. It is audio only. So maybe there'll be a nice still photo or something. I don't know.
The interview was fun and he's a really great interview. So,
well, I can't wait to hear it. Let's get into it.
Okay.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Well, I'm here with Alonzo Duraldi, who's here to talk about his new book, Hollywood Pride. So tell me a little bit about your book and what inspired you to write it.
Sure. Well, it's a history of queer Hollywood, both on screen and off. So it's about the movies that have, for better or worse, told LGBTQ plus stories, included LGBTQ plus characters. But it's also about the many artists, stars, but also directors and writers and cinematographers who made the movies happen. And actually, it was brought to me by Running Press. They've been doing the TCM books for a while now. And this is kind of, I think, unofficially part of a series they've been doing for Turner Classic Movies. A few years back, they published Donald Bogle's Hollywood Black, which was a, you know, history of black films and black artists, which is now actually being made into a TV documentary, which I'm very excited about, that Justin Simien and Forrest Whitaker are producing. And then a couple of years after that, they did Viva Hollywood by Luis Freyes, which was the sort of Latin A Hispanic version of that, the same thing. And so now this is the LGBTQ plus one.
Nice. Good. How long did it take you to write? I mean, it's extensive.
Less time than I would have liked. Okay. It was, they brought me the project and they also brought me a deadline. But you know, I'm a bit of a procrastinator, so I probably would have just, you know, gunned it in the last part anyway. But yeah, luckily I came in with a pretty decent sort of baseline knowledge of this history, but I absolutely was learning new things around every corner where I was like, oh, I didn't know about that movie or this person or this, you know, incident or whatever. So, yeah, it was a thrilling experience.
Oh, good. Do you want to give a little description of what it's about?
Sure. So basically, it's covering mostly the American film industry from, you know, its beginnings in 1895 all the way up to Everything Everywhere All at Once, I guess. And it's a look at how queer history evolved over those decades, you know, off the screen and, you know, in society, and then how that was reflected in the movies. And so it goes chronologically. Each chapter is usually a decade or two, and, you know, it kind of focuses on who were the important artists of that period, you know, again, whatever side of the camera they might have been on, and what were the films that were coming out that mm-hmm. were, you know, that were talking about LGBTQ plus lives, whether they were doing so well or badly, you know, obliquely in the case of the production code era where, you know, it was intended to erase queer lives entirely, but it just became a matter of like reading between the lines and looking at things from a certain angle. But, you know, we were still there.
Because there's so much history there, what made you decide what to include? And was there anything you didn't include that maybe you wanted to include, you know?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, I had about 95,000 words to cover 130 years. So I from the get-go in the introduction, I'm like, look, if I left out your favorite, I'm sorry. I did my best to try and, you know, put all of this historical sausage into the casing that I was allowed, you know. So, yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. There were folks who, and at the end of each section, I have kind of like a listing of other films and other people. So I tried to, you know, include as many folks as possible. But once you hit about 1990, it's really, there's no way at all to include all of the films and all of the artists, you know. So yeah, at some point you have to kind of make the hard choices. But I hope I was able to, you know, do enough of a cast a wide enough net to include, you know, people who really I think were important along the way. And you know, that the title implies that it's, you know, all American and it's all sort of studio product. But obviously you have international filmmakers doing queer films that had an impact in this country, you know. So the original La Cage aux Folles, or the films of, you know, Visconti or Fassbinder. And then obviously, you know, indie filmmakers play a role. And for queer cinema, you know, you have to talk about the underground, you know, with the Kenneth Anger and the Kushar brothers. You have to talk about pornography. Really, before the VHS era, that was kind of, you know, in the 1970s, certainly the only people that were really kind of telling stories about gay life were, you know, was happening in adult cinema. It certainly wasn't coming out of the studios, really. So all of those things kind of, you know, play a role in telling this story.
Right. It's interesting, though, to look at the films from the 1970s, like Dog Day Afternoon. My interest in kind of came in later with, actually with Hitchcock, which is kind of funny. I mean, from the 70s, but my parents were a big Hitchcock fan. So they showed us a bunch of Hitchcock movies when we were kids. And so, but it's funny to read your book now and look back at some of those movies and kind of see the context. And like, I recently rewatched Rope.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm in a film club with some friends, and it was like, oh, yeah, okay, I see that.
Yeah, Hitchcock becomes kind of a recurring figure in the book, where like in each decade, I'm like, meanwhile, over at Hitchcock.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that. So when it comes to representation, you know, that's also negative. So, you know, for example, like with Hitchcock, why do you think it's important to include that in the book?
Well, you know, I think that for a lot of film history, you know, negative inclusion is the only inclusion we got, you know, and so you can't ignore it or pretend it didn't happen. And I think it becomes part of the context for things that happen later. Although even with Hitchcock, I think that it wasn't necessarily all bad. You know, you look at characters like the mystery writer and her female companion in Suspicion, or, you know, Caldecott and Chalmers in Strangers on a Train. Like, I think that Hitchcock's playing around with this. I think that there is part of his sort of general, let's say, blanket of perversity that he just likes to kind of play around with the code and what he can get away with and what characters he can include. And Hitchcock's own sexuality has certainly been the subject of debate among film scholars and other folks. But yeah, I think he just sort of likes including that as sort of his larger tableau of human behavior and sort of motivation for characters. And so, you know, I don't think we necessarily have to hold up Mrs. Danvers in Rebecca as like a great queer role model, but she's there and she's fascinating and she's a great villain. Yeah. So, you know, she becomes part of the story that we're telling, you know?
Okay. So yeah, you don't think the portrayal is necessarily negative all the time.
Yeah, no, not always. Yeah. I mean, some of them, sure. You know, I think like, you know, like Mrs. Danvers, Martin Landau in North by Northwest. Like, these are some real, like, okay.
Well, the guys in Rope, for sure.
Oh, yeah, the guys in Rope are like straight up murderers. Yeah. You know, let's not forget them. But, you know, I just think that in a period where, you know, it was coming down from the mountain of, you know, the people running Hollywood, that you are not going to include anything like this or talk about these kind of characters or their lives or any of that stuff. Even negative inclusion is at least visibility and a reminder that we exist in the universe. And, you know, it's not the greatest reminder and it's not the ideal, but it's, I say, better than nothing.
Okay. All right. That's good. I just remembered what I was trying to remember before. Midnight Cowboy.
Okay. Midnight Cowboy, yes. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously, with the once the code goes away and the rating system comes in, you know, you have some efforts to be more inclusive. But films like Dog Day Afternoon and Midnight Cowboy are kind of the exception in that so many of the movies of that period, it's like, ooh, we can show, like, you know, lesbian murderers and, like, you know, foppish gay punchlines. You know, because most of the people making movies then are, you know, cis het white men, you know.
Right.
Obviously, John Schlesinger with Midnight Cowboy is one of the rare exceptions for that period. But yeah, so, you know, you kind of take what you can get where you can find it, you know, and I talk about films that have maybe less than savory queer characters. I talk about films that aren't specifically queer, but that have nonetheless garnered a queer cult following over the years. You know, there's a lot of different avenues by which to approach this topic.
Yeah, I was surprised about The Mummy. It's like The Mummy.
Me too. That was news to me. But, you know, I literally just went on social media one day and said, okay, bisexuals, what's your cult film? What is the film that is in no way specifically about bisexuality, but that, you know, is the secret handshake that y'all are all into? And overwhelmingly, the response was, oh yeah, 1999's The Mummy. I'm like, okay, didn't know that. But, you know, and I get it. Like, if you're, you know, of a certain age and kind of creating the impressions that will shape you, and you get a movie that gives you Rachel Weisz and Brendan Fraser and Arnold Vosloo and Patricia Velasquez and, you know, Tuck Watkins and Oded Fair, like, all right, that's a banquet.
Yeah, interesting. All right, so in your book, you definitely have some where you kind of just do summaries, and then others where you kind of pull out and do a bigger examination of the, mm-hmm. the movie and people. So how did you sort of decide to, like, go deeper and versus just sort of maybe doing a quick blurb?
You know, it's hard to say. It kind of varies from person to person, and it's very subjective. And I'm sure there will be readers who are like, why didn't you give me more of this and less of that? I'm like, yeah, you know, I was really trying to kind of, you know, focus on the people I think that were essential and important and moved the conversation forward in different ways, and whose work, whose legacy, you know, endures, whose films we're still talking about, whose performances we're still talking about. So yeah, there's not like a specific formula in mind. Like, it just kind of becomes a thing where you know, it's not the internet, you know, I can't just go off and take all the space I want. You know, I have a page count to work with. So yeah, I just kind of tried my hardest to, you know, throw a spotlight where it needed to go and try to at least, you know, include, you know, other things that maybe weren't going to get that same level of real estate, but that nonetheless were part of the conversation.
Right. Yeah. Especially for me, some of the early cinema stuff, which, you know, I didn't have a huge personal basis in, like, a lot of those films. So,
right. I mean, it's TCM, you know, you want to give the Turner Classic Movies audience that, you know, golden age of Hollywood as much as possible. And I think that, you know, so much of that early, the early stuff is fascinating, and we don't talk about it enough. We don't talk enough about, like, silent cinema in general, I think, when we're doing film scholarship. And I think the internet has created a generation of people who, oh, I love movies as long as they were made after 1990, you know. So, and I think that because so much of history is cyclical and, you know, we see things recurring over and over again, like, it's really essential to make sure that you've got that basis, because so much of things that are happening now, we aren't necessarily inventing. We're just sort of circling back around to something maybe that had already happened in our you know, time on this planet.
Yeah, I mean, like, a lot of the time when I talk to cinematographers, you know, they have a huge background, and they just go and they kind of, like, watch and kind of take from so many, like, old films, and just a huge variety. I mean, like, a lot of time, you know, several have mentioned things like Nosferatu, like the original, you know, and films like that. And then even Francis Ford Coppola with doing the, you know, Metropolis.
You know, I mean, you know, Orson Welles, when he was doing Citizen Kane, which is a real game changer, but he was you know, very influenced by not only John Ford, but also all those German expressionists, you know, mm-hmm. all those angles and the shadows and stuff, you know. So, yeah, I think nobody bursts out of the side of Zeus's head. You know, we're all sort of reshaping things that have come along before. And I think that it's important to talk about, certainly, you know, you bring up Nosferatu, like F.W. Murnau was queer, you know. Yeah, and so there are so many queer artists along the way who lay the groundwork, not just for queer cinema, but cinema, you know, capital C, the whole thing. You know, and I think you don't have the movies as we know them now without these artists along the way. And there is such a kind of conspiracy of historical erasure so often where, you know, certain politicians will try and paint the queer community as being just like, we never accomplished anything. Nobody knows us. Nobody likes us. You know, we don't matter. And so I think it's important to have books like this to be like, no, we did this and this and this. And if it weren't for this and this and this person and, you know, these innovations, this movie that you like wouldn't exist, you know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah, actually, one of the people we spoke with was Lena Sandgren about Saltburn and Nosferatu, you know, was definitely an influence there. So it's kind of interesting.
For sure.
So, you know, but yeah, you know, that kind of came out last year. So, you know, it's kind of a little more recent, but that would be probably one of the treacherous gays, I guess.
So. Yeah, I mean, sure. You know, there's a proud history of that, no question. You know, you could, I think there's a very strong line you can draw from Saltburn to like a Pasolini film called Teorema, where, you know, a young, hot Terrence Stamp is the interloper in the rich house, you know.
I'm sure that was an influence, yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I can't imagine that it wasn't. And I think, you know, there are certain times where you have characters that's like, are they even queer or are they just ready to be what the other person needs them to be at any given moment to get what they want? You know,
this is true.
Like I'm about to host a screening of All About Eve in Los Angeles. And there's a lot of back and forth about like Eve Harrington. Was she a lesbian? Did she have any sexuality at all beyond just rapacious ambition? You know, like, I don't know. It's that's interesting that like decades later, we can still sort of debate about this and figure out like what we think and what we can glean from their behavior in different ways. And so I'm certainly not the last word on anything. These are, you know, the movies that endure, we will continue to sort of like toss back and forth and chew on, you know, for as long as people are watching movies.
Right. And then you never know like what's going to spark somebody's, you know, creativity and influence them if they're a filmmaker.
Absolutely.
So, and I do like how you've done sort of, you can see the arc through your book of like how these, each thing kind of came after the other and influenced the next, you know, decade.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. What are some of the films that particularly resonated with you and made you really, you know, that you really enjoyed writing about?
Oh, gosh. It's hard to pick favorites. you know, I think I had seen it before writing the book, but I really loved getting into Salome. I think it's a sort of fascinating thing where you have, you know, Alina Zimova, who is this hugely paid, very successful actress. And she's like, I'm going to make this what is now considered sort of the first American avant-garde movie. Like, so she's throwing out the rule book and making this supremely queer film that's, you know, not only is it an Oscar Wilde adaptation, but like the visual style of it is sort of like setting the templates for like camp, basically, for the decades to come. And, you know, and it's a total failure at the time and you know, it destroys her personal fortune. But, you know, then endures later and becomes this movie that, again, we're still talking about it, you know, and people are still sort of discovering this movie. I just saw it at the Academy Museum about a month ago with like a live a musical accompaniment. And it's still a shocking film, like just shocking in the sense of like, I can't believe somebody made this, you know, it is so, you know, not what anybody was doing in the 1920s in mainstream cinema, you know? So films like that, you know, I think it's, you know, in looking at the 50s, it's such a, you know, there's not a lot to work with there. Like that's, not only do you have the production code, but it's that whole sort of weird post-World War II thing where it's like we're trying to reestablish the gender order because the women all went to work in the factories and now that we can't get them back in the kitchen fast enough, you know. But that gives you these movies like Caged, you know, which is on the one hand this very sort of like social dilemma drama in the vein of, you know, I'm a fugitive from a chain gang, but it's also this like, ladies, step right, or you know, this is what you're going to wind up with, you know. So that's really interesting. I mean, Ed Wood's Glenn or Glenda, which is a singularly bizarre film, but at the same time, it's like you're not going to find any other American director sort of like giving this plea for acceptance and understanding of cross dressers, you know, and tangentially trans women. Like he sold this movie to a producer who was like, oh yeah, I'm gonna make a movie about Christine Jorgensen, and then he makes this very personal thing about like, I love angora sweaters, you know. And so yeah, it is, you know, as much as, you know, Ed Wood gets the rap for being like the worst director ever, like he is kind of making this outsider art here. You know, and of course, what was cool about getting to like the 90s and the new queer cinema was that like I was around for that.
Yeah,
you know?
Me too. I was reading, so I'm like, oh, I've seen most of these.
You know, so that was kind of cool to sort of dig back into that period, because like one of my first jobs after college was working at the USA Film Festival in Dallas, and we screened Poison in 1990. And so, like, I remember what a huge deal that was, not just that it was, you know, it won the prize at Sundance, but like the way that that movie became the target of like the Jesse Helmses of the world. Like there was some right-wing rag in Dallas, like ran this big headline story about it, like front page, like, oh, the USA Film Festival is showing this filth. And they were like, they published the names of our sponsors. Like they were trying to go after us about it. It was a whole thing. And of course we sold out both shows, you know? And I think in a lot of ways, what really kind of raised the boats of those early queer films was the fact that, you know, all these, you know, Pat Buchanans of the world were fulminating about them on TV all the time. And so if you were not of their political stripe, you're like, oh, really? The Water Woman, well, I'll have to check that one out. You know,
oh, okay. I hate those movies. People, so I'm going to watch what they hate.
Exactly. Yeah. So all these movies, they got like 10 cents from the National Endowment for the Arts and, right. You know, they're getting decried on the floor of Congress. You know, you can't buy that kind of publicity for a little art house movie. So, so it was kind of cool to go through all of that again.
Yeah, that's neat. I was happy that you included the Mitchells versus the Machines too. I did really enjoy that film. So,
it was the only animated one
I think you included, right?
It is. I mean, yeah. I think I mentioned Paranorman in passing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if I'd written this book a year later, Nimona would be in there too. You know, like we are now finally starting to see, you know, and it's been happening quite a bit on television, but even now in feature films for kids, we're seeing these queer characters emerge. And that's a big step because I think, you know, the big canard that the right wing has always been able to fall back on is like, oh, won't someone think of the children, they're so impressionable. And it's like, you know what, the children, a lot of them are queer and would love to hear some tiny message somewhere telling them that they're okay and they're gonna be all right and have a real life. You know, heaven knows I knew I was a queer kid and I wasn't getting that anywhere.
Right.
So, you know, I'm glad that we've entered this era where we can, you know, include characters like this in what is considered sort of, you know, family aimed media. And, you know, the earth isn't gonna fall into the sun. And it's not about like, oh, we're showing kindergartners explicit sex. No, we're showing two guys who are knights like holding hands. Oh, no.
Yes. The cross dressers and the drag queens are all going to come and corrupt our children.
Exactly. Yeah. So. Believe your children are fine. Relax.
I took mine to a drag show last week.
Nice. Happy Pride.
Yeah, exactly. are there any untold stories like that you think of LGBTQ representation that you'd like to see in film?
Oh, God, tons. I mean, for the longest time, my answer to that question was, I want a biopic about Bayard Rustin. And I got one. So, I have to come up with new ones now. But no, there are so many stories waiting to be told. And I think, you know, Christy Vachon said this in a documentary, like, 15 years ago, that we really haven't told the story about the AIDS pandemic in this country and how it just devastated an entire generation of queer people. Like the people, I have a few mentors in my life that I feel lucky to have. But I mean, I'm in my late 50s. And so everybody I know who is like 65 and up, you know, I'll ask occasionally about that and they'll be like, oh yeah, like everyone I knew died. You know, every single name in my address book was, you know, got scratched out at some point. And so I think that's a story we haven't really told yet. I think there are a lot of, you know, I think, you know, there are stories about, I mean, you name it. I think we're just starting to scratch the surface of talking about like trans heroes in this country, about, you know, lesbian literary figures who are not Virginia Woolf or Emily Dickinson. You know, I think there's a whole panoply of stories waiting to be told. And I hope that we're getting to a place where, you know, artists get the leeway to tell them.
Yeah. So what do you think some of the challenges are that, you know, gay, trans and non-binary filmmakers face, you know, in this environment?
I mean, you know, I think it's the same challenges that all filmmakers face in terms of just like getting funding and getting their work out there. But I think with queer filmmakers, there is this notion of like, oh, it's so niche. Your audience is so small. And, you know, never thinking about the fact that, you know, there are like tons of straight people who would like to see these stories when they're done well. I think when it comes to like the studio level of filmmaking, it becomes very easy to sort of like quash that sort of stuff because it's like, well, you know, we're going to certain Asian countries are going to ban it,
or they're going to,
or they're going to dub over these characters. So we'll just better not to, you know, which is why like you get, you know, Marvel being like, oh, we gave you a gay character in the Avengers movie. And like, really? Who? Oh, you know, that guy in the support group. I'm like, oh, gee, thanks. You know?
Actually, some of their TV show series have, like, we watched Echo and that was pretty good. So
no, absolutely. I mean, like The Acolyte right now is, you know, the queerest thing Star Wars has ever done.
That's right.
And again, I think TV has a little more wiggle room sort of do that stuff, you know? But, you know, I think it's the same issue that you get whenever like a film that is centered on women's lives does well, or a film about people of color does well. It, rather than spawn like 10 imitators, they all become flukes. Oh, well, sure. Black Panther did well. Sex and the City did well. But that was a fluke. That was we certainly couldn't recreate that with other films aimed at the same audience that turned out in droves to see this movie. And also all the people not in that community who turned out in droves to see that movie. I talk about in the book, like Brokeback Mountain, I was working at The Advocate at the time and we were like, oh, here it comes. We've broken through. This movie was a financial hit. It was a critical hit. It won awards. Words, here come the gay. No, we're not. Okay, all right. Well, never mind then. You know, so yeah, that's the stuff you have to contend with. As somebody who was furious on the Oscar night that Brokeback Mountain lost to that other movie, I would have never predicted that, like within 10, 15 years, Moonlight would be this low budget, you know, black queer film from a director who cites, you know, Wong Kar-wai and Claire Denis as his influences. Like, okay, well, I guess the world is changing. But the thing is, like, the world does change. I mean, my husband and I, when we originally got married in 1997, it was like we got married in quotes because it wasn't legally recognized anywhere. And frankly, we didn't think it would be within our lifetime, you know. And then cut to 18 years later, the Supreme Court, you know, legitimizes our relationship and we can file joint taxes now. So you never know. But that said, as quickly as things change, they can also be reversed.
Yeah,
so
I know.
We can never like get too comfy.
Exactly. In all aspects.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I think you kind of answered it, but yeah, it was just what are your hopes for the future of, you know, queer cinema in Hollywood? Just more of
more of it, you know. I think it's really exciting that we're having this kind of kind of a trans new queer cinema right now. I mean, you know, we've already this year we've had the People's Joker and I saw the TV glow. And I feel like that trans filmmakers are getting an access to, you know, wide release cinema in a way that they haven't in the past.
Yeah.
And they're telling very kind of very uniquely personal stories with their own sort of, you know, they're coming of age tales that are told in a different way. And I think they're really directly sharing those experiences that I find fascinating as, you know, an older cis gay guy. You know, they're dealing with very specific cultural references that I don't necessarily always get. You know, I didn't grow up watching Buffy as a teenager, you know, so I have to kind of do the translating work. But that's great. Like, that's what's great about art. Like, if I'm seeing a film from, you know, a Thai filmmaker and it's about, you know, he's looping in kind of different specific kind of religious mysticism, I want to find out what that is, you know, and enjoy the film at that level. And so, yeah, I want to see more queer films. I want to see young queer filmmakers finding their voice and maybe finding their voice in a way that makes my generation have to work a little to get it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Like The Mummy.
Like The Mummy, exactly.
Well, I think that's about all that I have. So is there anything Ooh. Else that, how about this? Is there anything that no one's asked you yet that you would like to talk about?
Oh, gosh.
I mean, you've done a lot of these, so that's probably hard to think about.
I can't think of anything, but I should write that down for the next time somebody asks me that.
Sometimes you're like, I didn't get to talk about this thing, you know, whatever. But yeah. No, I like to ask that. That's always a good one.
No, that is a good one. I mean, I would say that, you know, I just think that the scope of this book was, you know, on the one hand, daunting, and on the other hand, it felt like there was just so much more to talk about, you know. So as much as I like to think I've tried to cover the high points, I am at best skimming the surface of a very deep topic. And certainly when it comes to international film, like that's a whole other series of books unto itself. You know, I'm mainly, like I said, focusing on American film. But, you know, and I think also that there are so many queer artists who will never know were queer, you know, who like so successfully lived these closeted lives and got married and had kids and, you know, colored between the lines that maybe we don't know what the real story is. And there are even people I put in the book where I'm like, we think we don't know.
Yeah, that was really interesting and surprising to read about some of that. I didn't know anything about.
You know, it, so. And certainly what I really hope is that if you are a fan of anybody that you read about in this book, that you don't somehow think that this is somehow, I'm denigrating their memory by, you know, dragging them into this cesspool. No, it's like I'm celebrating the fact that they were awesome and they were also queer, and that maybe that knowledge will allow you to look at their work through a different lens or with a different perspective, but they're still great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. Well, thanks for joining me, Alonzo. Oh, it was good to talk
pleasure.
To you about Hollywood Pride.
Thanks for having me. Oh, it's sure. It's a book, it's an ebook, and it's an audiobook.
Nice.
So wherever you pick those up, please do. And if you want to bug your local library to carry all three of those editions, that'd be swell too.
Great. Sounds good. Mine, it's still on order at my library.
So that was Alonzo Duralde. Hey, Alonzo, thank you so much for being on the show. Can't wait to have you back on again, hopefully sooner than later.
And check out his book. For God's sakes.
Check out his book.
Hollywood. Read a book. Yeah. I don't do enough reading.
Yes, it's called Hollywood Pride. You can pick it up in your local bookstores or on Amazon. And it's
Kindle? Is it on Kindle?
I don't know. But
I'm going to go with probably. Most books are.
But it's really nice. It's a nice book. It's very well designed. It's got lots of pictures. It's a pretty easy read because, you know, it's broken up into chunks and you can just kind of go through it at your leisure. It's kind of like a coffee table style kind of thing book. And you can go through it and kind of pick out era. He divides it by different eras, and it goes starting from the history of cinema from the very beginning all the way through to now.
Nice.
Yeah. It's very thorough.
All right, team. You'll never guess what time it is.
What time?
10:04.
Okay. It is time to pay the bills.
Yay.
Our fine friends over at Aputure, maker of high quality lights for the motion picture and television and online web industry. They do all kinds of crazy great lights, and they've got a brand new one. This is hot off the presses. They call it the 1200X. Now, the 1200X is similar to the 1200D, except it is bicolor. It allows you to do full tungsten, full daylight, and all of the spectrum in between. They're calling it full spectrum lighting. And they have a new 5 LED color engine they call Blair: blue, lime, amber, indigo, and red. And with all of these extra LED units, you get a even better tungsten and an even better daylight. And you remember that Aputure purchased a company called ProLight a while ago. ProLight has some really, really made some really, really great lights. And one of their cool features was a locking bayonet Bowens mount. That mount seems to have been brought over to this new Aputure light called the Storm 1200X, and their tagline is beyond bicolor, and it's IP65 rated. It's now available for pre-order, of course, over at Hot Rod Cameras. If you are interested in the new Aputure 1200X, go to Hot Rod Cameras. We got a pre-order going. I'm sure you can get on the list, and as soon as it's available, we will ship it out to you. If there's any other questions about it, of course, hit me up personally at Hot Rod Cameras. I'm going to get a full lesson on this light in the coming days. This information is less than 12 hours old, and I really just saw the dealer information that went out this morning, but really exciting. Really wanted to share it with everyone. If you're in the market for new, bright, bicolor lights, take a look at the Aputure 1200X.
Wow, it's the first time I've ever heard of the five-color system, the Blair system.
Yeah, it's new, and it looks really cool. It's got really precise coordinates too. You can set what's known as XY to pick the exact color of light that you want. So,
the technology is just freaking amazing. I was on a shoot as editor. I wasn't directing, but I was on a corporate video project last week, and it was all Aputure. Every friggin' instrument was an Aputure light. It was pretty amazing to see. Like, they have taken over. Mm.
And now, Short Ends.
All right. So it is now time for our famed Short Ends. It's our pet obsession of the week. What is your obsession this week, Ben?
My obsession this week is it's both a podcast and a YouTube channel, and it's kind of goofy. This is lighter fare. I tend to go darker and suggest something that would, you know, be a deep dive for somebody. It's a podcast and a YouTube channel called This Aged Great. And it's two comedians, Ben Moore and Jordan Elias. And they kind of do these, like, it is a snackable show. Each episode is about 10 minutes long. And they do basically an episode about, you know, I'm kind of scrolling through the ones that they have here. It's stuff like Soul Man, the 1980s movie where C. Thomas Howell becomes black so he can get into Harvard, or The Blue Lagoon, or Tiptoes, the movie where Gary Oldman plays a little person, Milk Money, Crash, Oscar winner Crash, Rhinestone, the Dolly Parton and Sylvester Stallone comedy, 16 Candles, and my personal favorite, The Thing with Two Heads, which if you don't watch any other episode, check out their episode about The Thing with Two Heads, because a lot of times they're kind of leaning on what didn't age especially well. And it's just two comedians kind of cracking on it. And usually I think the Ben guy has seen the movie and he's explaining it to the other guy. And sometimes it's stuff like Roadhouse, which is like a beloved classic. Like, I dare you to not like Roadhouse, but it's just kind of funny how they kind of put a spin on it. But definitely The Thing with Two Heads, chef's kiss, made me want to see the movie, actually. And that's a movie from, I think, the early 70s. And it looks hilariously, unabashedly screwed up racially, like in its approach to race, but in ways that you would not expect. Anyway, I encourage everyone to check it out. It's funny, it's fun, it's short. Enjoy.
Cool. Yeah, there's nothing like watching certain movies that you like have fond memories of when you were a kid and showing it to your kid and being like, oh shit, what, that was not what I remembered.
Yeah, even like stuff that seemed kind of benign, you know,
Yeah, exactly.
we almost showed my son Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and then I remembered that there's like some very casual homophobia that would be considered like there'd be protests around the block if you had lines like that in a movie today, rightfully so. And I'm not saying I'm like I don't think that they're saying like, hey, we should crap on the past. Well, their theme song is, you know, the lyrics are the past was doing its best. I think that sums it up. But you know, like I'm not one of these people who's like, hey, let's never look at these old movies. But I do think that sometimes you go back and look at, you know, 16 Candles is a good example.
It is. And I was thinking of Gremlins. Like, we showed them Gremlins, and it's like, you know,
What didn't hold up? I just watched Gremlins like 2 months ago and I
the
thought it was
beginning
wonderful.
where it's kind of racist in the beginning. There's the guy, I forgot
Oh
who the
yeah.
actor was, in yellow face,
King
basically. Like, oh, it's the
Kong?
Chinese, you know, stereotype guy
Yeah.
selling the, you
I
know.
guess yeah, that's I guess that's true. I guess
My
that's true.
kids are like, this is cringe.
Really?
Yeah,
Interesting.
totally.
That's too bad. I've looked forward to showing that to
They
my
did
son.
like the movie, but I'm like, you know, just forget that part. But you know, it's funny what does hold up, because then we showed them Alien and Aliens,
Oh
and
God, yeah.
yeah, it's still good. So anyway,
Those movies are bulletproof. When
yeah.
they re-released Alien in theaters for its what 45th anniversary, like 6 months ago, I'd never seen it on the big screen, and it I believe was the original cut, the theatrical cut, not the director's cut, which is what you usually get now. And that movie, outside of some of the special effects, makeup, like the stuff around Ash doesn't look modern. Everything else about that movie looks like it could have come out last week. I just the way it's shot, the way it's lit, the monster effects, everything about that movie is just freaking perfect. Holy
Yeah.
crap.
All right. Hey, Alana, do you have a
I
short end for us this?
do. I
You
do.
have a
I'm
short one?
excited.
All
Okay.
right.
All right. You guys will like this too.
Okay.
Okay, so, and it's a podcast,
All right.
and
I'm there already.
it's cool because it's a very doable podcast. It's six episodes, and each episode is like 30 to 40 minutes long. So it's like a limited podcast. So it's called Shell Game, and it's hosted by Evan Ratliff, and he is a journalist. And so basically, he decides to create an AI clone of himself, and in each episode, he has the clone of himself try to do different things. So in the funniest part, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. So in like the first episode, he uses some new AI technology that's kind of to totally clone his voice, which you guys got to experience some of that from our friends Andy Lemon and Charles Papert.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah, no, but this is really good. He found this company that does a really good job of cloning your voice, and he created a script for it too. Like, he created this like long, like 8 page long. He basically gave it all this information about himself because he has it go to therapy for him. So because there's AI that is that, so he has his AI talk to another AI therapist.
Oh my God.
That's
That's our
one of the
future.
episodes. And then the
I've been saying
second.
about when people talk about making movies using generative AI, I'm like, if only we can get an AI that can watch the movies, then they can just go off and entertain themselves.
Absolutely. And pay
Yeah.
the price.
So he trains it up to get fairly sophisticated. I mean, there's some issues with it. It's got a little bit of lag when it's trying to respond to somebody, and it's very funny. And the thing that made me laugh out loud the most was he did a clone of his AI, a second clone. And he had the clones talk to each other. So himself talking to himself. So two AIs of himself.
Oh my
And
God.
yeah. And it was super crazy. The funniest part is it took them 5 minutes to stop the conversation because it had been trained to not never be the one to end the conversation.
That's
So it was like, hey, it was really great talking to you. We should catch up again sometime. Another AI is like, yeah, that'd be great. But yeah, we should totally do that. It was really great talking to you too. Yeah, this is awesome. We should do this again.
We all
Yeah,
know
this is,
that person.
it's just keeps going on and on. Anyway, it's a great show, you guys. It's very entertaining. It's you know, it's very interesting to delve. It delves into like what are the realities here? What he gets to really take it for a spin and see what how good is it? You know, what should we be afraid of? It should, you know, it's not, and he's not saying either way, like. Because it isn't really fooling anyone at for like most people figure it out that this is not a real person after they've talked to the AI for a little bit. You know what I mean? But
Didn't we think that like wasn't the whole buzz on this next election that it was going to be all AI and people were going to be fooled by AI left and right? And I have to say, I have seen zero evidence that anyone's been fooled by any AI anything in this entire election.
well,
I
I don't
mean,
know. They have,
we
you
still have 2 months,
know.
but still.
The State Department's already said we have to like watch out. There's Russian meddling happening and
Yeah, but in terms of like
all that.
AI, it's like any generative AI photo, it's like, hey, I know Joe Biden doesn't have six fingers on that hand, you know.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, this is strictly voice. He isn't doing any video. He's strictly doing just his audio. So so yeah, it's worth a listen. It's six episodes, and each episode's like 30 to 40 minutes. Oh, and another one that was great is he has the AI call back every single spam call and scammer call.
Oh, that
And
sounds
yeah.
like gold.
Anytime he, yeah, so he actually had to fish to get the spam started coming
Oh,
in to him, which didn't take long.
you
And
just sold
then
one ticket to that podcast I don't have to pay for. I'm totally doing that now.
So that episode's great. That's like episode two. So
Well, guess what I'm
anyway,
spending the rest
yeah,
of my
give it
week
a
doing?
listen. It's fun. I basically just zipped right through it while I was building my greenhouse. So anyway.
All right, Ilya, what is your pet fascination this week?
It's called Terminator Zero, and it is a new Netflix series actually produced, co-produced by Skydance, you know, of all the fame that we were talking about over the
Yeah,
last.
who just bought Paramount.
Exactly. So, and by all accounts, it seems to be doing pretty well. The reviews online have also been pretty positive. I binged it. You know, it's an interesting sort of trend that's happening right now. There is another anime series that was a take on Star Wars, which they called Star Wars Visions. It was on Disney Plus. And
There's also a Rick and Morty anime, which I started watching, and I have to say I couldn't get into it. And maybe I need to give it another shot.
I didn't
As
know this.
a huge Rick and Morty fan, it's on Max. I started watching it, and I'm like, this joke is too sophisticated for me. I don't get it.
There was also the Cyberpunk anime, which is a property. It's a video game property, but I've also heard rumors of a live action version of that coming. So it's kind of interesting. It's the latest in this sort of trend of taking a property that is beloved in science fiction and bringing it to the anime world. Of course, anime, you know, the inspiration for movies like The Matrix and stuff with things like, you know, Akira and Ghost in the Shell. Well, this version of Terminator, Terminator Zero, is, I believe, an eight-part series, and it held my interest from beginning to end. It was a you know, fresh, original take, but it still felt familiar. It kind of retells a story we've already seen, but it does it in a new way. And I'm not going to give it away, but yeah, if you are looking for something that is pretty much turn your brain off entertainment, and you know, animation anime is not your enemy, then give it a try. It's on Netflix now.
Awesome.
Cool.
All right. Well, I think that just about does it for this episode. Ben, where can people find you if they want to track you down outside of the show?
Please check me out at benrock.com. Just go there. You can find all my social media hooks and stuff. And if you want, you can add me on LinkedIn or, you know, if you want to talk business, if you want to hear me complain about politics, follow me on Twitter. And if you want to see pictures of my kid and my dog, follow me on Facebook. How about yourself? Actually, let's go to Alana. Where can people find you, for God's sakes?
Oh, well, I mean, I also am in charge of all the social media around the Cinepod. So you can also, if you really feel like it, you can, I guess, DM us there at the Cinepod on Instagram, and we have our Facebook page too. But I guess let us know how we're doing.
And Ilya, where can people find you?
You can find me at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. Here today in Burbank, lots of interesting new gear type stuff happening here in the industry, and we are making it happen every day. So you can also find us hopefully this month in Portland, Oregon. The new shop is coming together. So I think that's just about gonna do it for us. But we gotta thank a couple of people. One of them is on this episode right now.
Thank yourself, Alana. Thank yourself. It's so weird.
All
It'd be the
right, I'll pat
weirdest thing ever
myself
to
on the back.
Yeah,
There
Alana, do you
we
want to
go.
thank everyone? Is that too weird?
Sure, I can do it. And I want to thank our editor, Michael Dispenza, who I'm sorry, we made this a little harder with a few false starts. But thanks for sticking with it. And also, we want to thank Kay Zalatrachi for all the music. And every scrap of music that you hear on the show, as Ben likes to say, is from Kay's. So.
All right. And so I'm really glad that you're here, Alana, because you get to take us out.
Thank God.
thanks for tuning in.
But you know what? That's probably better than anything else that we did.
That's the best one we've had in a long time. I
That's
agree.
really good.
You
Okay.
just gotta, commit.
I refuse.
Yeah, that's too hard.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.